They're up to me. We don't know the recordings.
Take just a little bit. Actually, we're just going to kind of piggyback off of last week's lesson, which last week's lesson was kind of a little bit of a detour from the book. In a sense, we talked about some people in our own lives who have been an example of what he's talking about in the book. A person who is very selfless, a person who puts God first in their life, a person who shows love toward others that in an amazing way. And we all see people and we know people in our lives that are like that. And all of us, as we have been challenged by this book, we want to be more like that. I want to put the things that I desire, that I want to put those things on the back, and I want to put the things that God desires for me on the front. And I want, and I know that what he desires for me is he wants me to love him first. He wants me to love him with everything that I've got. And he wants me to love those around me, no matter how difficult it is to love not only my brothers and sisters in Christ, but those that are outside of Christ, and also those who may even be our enemies. He challenges us to love. And so it's just an attitude of love that permeates within our hearts. A couple weeks ago, I preached a sermon upstairs, and I know that I can talk a little bit about it because you probably don't remember anything about it. So I know Sean was asleep, so I know he didn't get anything. So, but I talked about Peter, and in Acts chapter 4, we looked at it's right after the day of Pentecost, and Peter is preaching. And we talked about how he was very bold by preaching the truth. And he didn't hold anything back. He just said what needed to be said. And that he was being very effective. And that people were following him. People were listening to him. But then those Pharisees and the Sadducees and those guys got a hold and heard what he was preaching and didn't like it, because it was sort of an indictment on them. And so they grab a hold of Peter and his companions, and they put him in jail. We don't know what to do with him, so we'll just put him in jail. We'll hold him in there. And what had happened was, right, he had healed somebody. He had healed, I think it was a lame man. He had healed him. And the lame man was jumping around, and everybody saw that he was healed, and they couldn't deny the fact that this guy was healed, and Peter had a hand in that. And so they were questioning, how do we deal with the situation? And so what their decision was is that we would pull them aside and we would say, don't do it anymore. Stop preaching and teaching. Do you know who we are? We can make your life miserable. We can put you in prison. We can have you killed. We can do all this stuff. So you better just stop preaching. And then Peter, in verse 19 of chapter 4, he says, whether it is right in the sight of God to listen to you more than to God, you judge. But we cannot but speak the things which we have seen and heard. And so, Peter had gotten to a point in his life that he was not afraid to step out. Right? I mean, these were people that ordinarily, most people in their culture, in their religion, were afraid of. You know, it's somebody who they wanted to put their thumb on everybody. They wanted to be in control of everyone. And for the most part, they had that control. Except Peter refused to allow them to do that to him. And as I think about Peter, and I think about, down in 13 it says, Now when they saw the boldness of Peter and John, so they marveled at their boldness. These guys, in secret, they come out and they're all, you better stop doing this, and throwing their weight around. And then, but in private, they're like, who are these guys? These are guys that have never had any training. These are guys that are just fishermen. They're just ordinary, normal, run-of-the-mill guys. How could they possibly stand up to us like this? How could they be so bold to be standing out by themselves, to be standing outside of the box that we've talked about, and just saying what needs to be said, no matter what happens to them? And I really think that was their attitude. You can do whatever you want to me. You can persecute me, you can kill me, you can put me in prison, you can beat me till kingdom come, but I'm not going to stop talking about this. how did Peter get to this point in his life? And that's what I kept thinking about. I've kind of been obsessed and studying a little bit about Peter and about his life lately. But how did he get there? And I go back and I look at a little bit of a brief synopsis of his life. We don't know that much about Peter before he was called. Okay, before he was called by Jesus. But turn with me over to 1 Peter. I'll find this verse here. 1 Peter chapter 4. 1 Peter chapter 4. He says, starting in verse 1, it says, and this is Peter speaking, "Therefore, since Christ suffered for us in the flesh, arm yourselves also with the same mind. For he who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, that he no longer should live the rest of his time in the flesh for the lusts of men, but for the will of God." Peter had gotten to the point in his life to where he realized that, hey, you know, the things that I want, I've just got to lay those things back. I've got to lay those things aside. And I've got to focus on the things that God wants. I've got to focus on His will. Then he says in verse 3, "For we have spent enough of our past lifetime in doing the will of the Gentiles, when we walked in licentiousness, lust, drunkenness, revelries, drinking parties, and abominable idolatries. In regards to these, they think it strange that you do not run with them in the same flood of dissipation, speaking evil of you." What do you notice about that, about those verses right there? It says, "For we have spent time." He's not talking about, he's like, "All right, Matt, you've spent enough time in drunkenness and revelries that you need to stop it." No, that's true. But you need to stop it. No, that's not what he says. What does he say? "We have spent all of our time in drunkenness and revelries and drinking parties." He talks about this living a lifestyle, he says, of the Gentiles. Doing the things that I want to do. Doing the things that feel good to me. The things that that are popular to the world. The things that make me a success in the world. He says, "We have spent enough time in that lifestyle." So it seems like to me that maybe Peter has given us a glimpse into his background. Maybe. And I don't know how much he can read into this, but he was a fisherman. You know, most fishermen live a pretty wild, I guess, lifestyle. But he says, you know, in the past, I was a pretty bad guy. I mean, you know, I was religious, I guess. But I spent time doing my own will, following my own way, doing the things that I wanted to do. In all these things, he says, like licentiousness and lust and drunkenness, revelries, drinking parties, idolatries. Yes?
I was going to say, I think that even if he wasn't talking about himself, that for anybody to talk about any of these things, you have to have experience in doing it. You know, I think any of the other apostles who say anything about it probably knew about it.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. You know, and Paul all the time was always saying "we," right? When we... Because Paul knew a little bit about, Paul knew a little bit about living a pretty bad lifestyle too. He knew a lot about doing things against the will of God. And so it makes it, and think about this for a second. Let's say, I'm just trying to think of someone. I think of a preacher. The first person that comes into mind is Sellers Crane, because I was co-minister with him for so long. Sellers gets up in the pulpit and he says, "Well, I've got to tell you some things about myself in the past." And actually, I've had this conversation with Sellers. And what's the first thing you think of? Hey, Sellers didn't do those things. Oh, I mean, this is Sellers. I mean, he's a preacher. He's been talking about all these things for years and years and years. Sellers didn't do those things. And I imagine in their mind, this is Peter. I mean, this is the guy in the church. And now he's standing up saying what? I used to not be a very good guy. I used to do a lot of things that were wrong. Are you? Really? You, Peter? He got to the point in his life where people looked at him and they saw his life, but yet it wasn't where he started. And so he can, not only it helps him to relate to those people around him, but he's kind of maybe confessing a little bit here to them. Maybe they already knew it. Maybe he's told them lots of times. Maybe they knew about this. But he says, we. So here he is saying, I didn't start out where I am now. I didn't start out being, and he was always a very humble person, right? It's like when people would try to bow down to him, what would he always say? You get up. I'm just a guy like you. It's recorded in Scripture, I think, more than once, where they tried to worship him like a god. And of course, no. I mean, I'm good, but how would we handle that? But Peter, he got embarrassed by it. He was, whoa, get up. I'm just a guy here. So Peter was a very humble person, but he didn't start out where he was as the super Christian that we see him as in Acts chapter 2 and later on.
He didn't start out all that humble either.
Well, that's true. Yeah. That's a good point.
You're going to tell Jesus, you're going to wash my feet. He had a humbling experience that started to wake him up. When he told Jesus, there's no way I'll deny you. And yes, you will. You're going to do it three times. You're going to do it three times before the sun comes up. And then you're going to have to live with it.
Yeah, so don't get too far. Get into my points.
Sorry, I'm sticking here.
I'll come back to you. That's true. I mean, he did not seem to be a very humble person when he started out as an apostle. Seemed to be kind of the arrogant, a little bit of the blowhard, the guy that always had to kind of be the one that, something had to be said, he was going to be the one to say it. If you think about it, Jesus came to him, and what did he ask him to do? First encounter with Jesus that we know of. What I'd like you to do, Peter, is like, here, take this, okay, I understand it wasn't written yet. Take this New Testament, and I'd like for you to study about me a little bit, okay? I'd like for you to go back to the prophet Isaiah. I'd like for you to just a little bit of study and research, all right? I'm going to give you about 3 months, and I'm going to come back to you, and then I'm going to ask you a question. I'm going to see if you'll do something for me. Is that all right with you? What did he do?
He said, come follow me.
What I want you to do is I want you to drop everything you're doing, and I want you to come follow me. And as far as we know, Peter didn't question. He didn't ask. He just dropped his stuff and he went. Now, we don't know exactly how all that worked out. I mean, did he get to go back home and say something to his family before he left? Or did he just leave and they didn't know where he was? I mean, but we know that pretty much he just dropped everything. His job, his livelihood, his family. And he said, okay, I'll follow you. I have enough faith in you that I'm going to follow you. This is a guy he knew very little about. But yet he did it. So the beginning of his life, the beginning was very strong, wasn't it? And really, we think about, and it's not to this extent, all right? But we think about when all of us decide to become followers of Jesus. What does God ask us to do? He asks us to drop everything. Now, we make a decision to do that, and we don't always follow through on it. But yet, that's what he asks us. You've got to drop your old life. You've got to drop the life of sin. You've got to give in to the will of God. You've got to follow God's teachings. You can't no longer follow your own stuff. And so he basically asks us the same question, and all of us have accepted that same thing. And sometimes, it's not exactly the same, but it's similar. So here's Peter. A little bit later, and I'm not sure I got all this stuff in order, but a little bit later, they're in a boat. And the storm is just going back and forth and back and forth. And they look out on the sea and they see this dude walking across the water. And immediately they're afraid. Wouldn't you be afraid? Who knows who we might be? And we've watched enough Deadliest Catch to know that, couldn't be anything good coming across on that water, right? Well, it's closer that Jesus comes, he says, it's me. And Peter says what? For some strange reason. That looks really cool. I want to do that too. Can I come out there? I mean, it's not as if it's still waters and, it's a storm. And Jesus said, "There, come on." And so Peter steps out of the boat, and he does pretty good for a little while, until what? He starts looking around, and he starts seeing the waves and the wind and everything, and he starts losing his faith. He gets afraid. And he begins to drop into the sea. And Jesus grabs his hand and he picks him up and he says something to him. What does he say? "Why do you have such little faith? Why do you doubt me?" This is a guy that had just left everything for Jesus. And now he's questioning his faith. So then he does that. Then he comes to, this is like Matthew chapter 16. And there are other things in here too that we're not going to have time to get to. But he gets to the point to where Jesus comes to him and he says, "Okay, who am I?" Seems like a pretty simple question, right? Who am I? What does Peter say?
"You are the Christ, Son of God."
Yeah. Said, "You are Jesus Christ, the Son of God." And I don't know why. I mean, it seems like maybe all the disciples should have known that, but it seemed like Jesus took it as a pretty big deal that he said it that way, didn't he? Because everybody else was questioning who he was. Oh, he's just some prophet, or he's this, or he's that. He's just a great teacher, or, you know, and there are people all throughout our world who question, we have that belief and understanding, but so many people throughout the world questioned who Jesus really was. Was he just a great teacher, or he was just a really good man who lived one time, or, you know, whatever. But Peter comes out and he gives the right answer. He gives the Jesus answer, right? Jesus. And so Jesus tells him, "Based upon what you just said, based on that confession, that's where I'm going to build my church." And he gives Peter a very interesting job. And what was the job? He said, "I'm going to give to you
keys
to the kingdom." And a lot of people question what that really is. And Bill Johnson, I heard him give this lesson a million times about this verse. But he says that the keys of the kingdom were the way to get into the church. And so the one that stands before the church on Acts chapter 2, the one that stands before, not the church, before the assembly there on the day of Pentecost was who? Peter. He told them, "How do I become a member? How do I become a part of God's church?" Who was the one that preached the very first sermon to the Gentiles? It was Peter. So Peter had a very special place in God's kingdom based upon his understanding of who Jesus was. Then, turn to this section real quick. Matthew 16. I think that's right. That's not right. Yeah. Mark. Okay. 19. Verse 19 gives him the keys to the kingdom. It says, "Whatever you bind on earth, I will be bound on earth. Whatever you bind in heaven, we'll be bound in heaven." All right? Gives them this special job. And then, verse 23. He says to Peter, what? Verse 23. Matthew 16, 23. Jesus says to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan." I mean, we're talking three verses. He's just giving him the keys to the kingdom, and he's calling him Satan. Why was he calling him Satan? Right on.
Question.
So he was so evil?
No, because there was talk of Jesus going to be killed. Peter's trying to talk him out of these things going to happen to you.
He had given him the right answer about who he was, but he didn't even realize what his purpose was on the earth. Right? Which, he wasn't necessarily the only one. But here is, I mean, Peter has the keys to the kingdom in his hand. He's not even put them in his pocket yet. And Jesus is calling him Satan. Because he doesn't understand the purpose of why Jesus came. What the purpose of those keys are. He doesn't even understand what he's been given yet. So then, here's Jesus, I mean, here's Peter, and he is waiting in the garden. He's been told by Jesus already that he's going to deny him, right, at the Final Supper. He's been told that he's going to deny him. He said, no, woman, I'll never do that. I'll never ever deny you. And to prove that point, he sticks a sword in his belt. All right? Nobody's going to, I'll show them. So he goes out and he's waiting with Jesus as he's praying. And Peter hadn't had much sleep lately, and so he cannot stay awake. He just comes back and keeps saying, hey, guys, would you mind staying awake? Your whole job is to be here to watch. Watch out. And keep falling asleep. And then the soldiers come up. And who's the first one to jump up, pull his sword out, and start to whack people in the head? It's Peter. But then just a few hours later, where is he? Hiding. He's denied Jesus and he's hiding. And then just a few days later, he's standing on a pedestal at the day of Pentecost and he's preaching the first sermon. Seems like kind of a roller coaster, doesn't it? I mean, up and down and up and down. It wasn't as if Peter just all of a sudden became what he was when we find out in Acts chapter 4 when he stands before the people and says, I don't care what you say, I'm not going to deny him. I don't care what you say, I'm going to stand for what he said. I'm going to tell the truth. I'm not going to let you back me down from that. Is this the way that it sort of feels maybe in your own life sometimes with your Christian walk? We make a decision to follow him, and from there, it seems like just it's a roller coaster ride. One minute I'm on a high and I'm able to conquer the world, and the next minute I'm hiding under a bed, not wanting anybody to talk to me. And that's exactly the way that Peter's life was. And as he's standing there, with the Pharisees and those guys, and he's being bold and he's telling them the way it is. He didn't get there overnight. He didn't get there. He got there because of all of those times when he was hiding under the bed. And he finally decided, I think, it's time. I'm not hiding anymore. I'm not going to hide under the bed anymore. I'm not going to deny Jesus. I'm not going to make the same mistakes that I continued to make the whole time that Jesus was here. From the time that he became a follower of Jesus to the time that he was the most bold that we see in his life, he had so many downfalls and pitfalls. Can anybody relate to that with me? Sometimes I feel so guilty that I do fall down, that I do have issues, that I'm not the Christian that I want to be, that I don't stand outside the box and stand in boldness before other people. I don't stand in boldness in just the life that I live. And I look like I look at a great man like Peter, who Jesus chose for a very specific purpose, knowing his faults. Don't you think the very first time that Jesus looked in Peter's eyes, he knew his faults? He knew the things that he was going to do, good and bad. And yet he still chose him to be the one. He had such an ultimate potential, but he didn't reach it very often, unfortunately. And so here's Peter as an example to us of the fact that we don't always get it right all the time. And it takes a while, it takes a process to get there. And think about this for a second. Who trained Peter to be a follower? Jesus himself. He had the best. He had the guy tutoring him, telling him what he should do and what he shouldn't do. He had the example right there in front of his face, and he still failed. He still denied it. He still did things that didn't seem like they were in character for who Peter should be. So how can we possibly expect to be somewhere where we want to be just overnight when we don't, I mean, we have his teachings and we were able to go to him in prayer and we're able to see those around us who are good examples, but Peter had the guy there and he still messed up. One thing I want to point out from before we quit, from 1 Peter chapter 4, where we were a minute ago. Peter talks about, and I really think that this was another thing that that Peter struggled with in his own life, and we could get into that some more, but we'll just, since I said it, we'll just leave and go with it. He talks about how he used to live. Okay? He says, we've got to put our own will on the back burner. We've got to live a life that's worthy of God. We've got to put all this, the way that the Gentiles live, we've got to put that behind us. And he goes on down and he says in verse 5, they will give an account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. For this reason, the gospel was preached also to those who were dead, that they might be judged according to men in the flesh, but live according to the Spirit. But the end of all things is at hand. Therefore, be serious and watchful in your prayers. He says, okay, we've got to know that the end is at hand. We've got to have this attitude that Jesus could return any day. So what should I be doing? Okay, he's already said, you can't live a life of sin. You've got to turn away from that. I would venture to say that that's not any of our problem. Okay, not that we don't sin, but we've all decided to turn away from that life. Okay, we're gonna fall into the same temptations a lot of times. We're gonna fall into some of the same sins, but I don't think there's a single one of us in here that hasn't decided to turn from sin. He says that's the first step. I've got to turn away from that life. Then he says, and above all things. Somebody says, above all things. What do they mean? Teacher's teaching in class, and he says, now, you don't know anything about anything that I've said. This is the most important. Above all things that I've taught, this is what I want you to know something about. It means I should know it. It's important. It's a priority. He says, above all things, have fervent love for one another. For love will cover a multitude of sins. So it's not enough just to turn away from sin. Then I have to then have an attitude of love. This is Peter talking. And I think he struggled with this. As we all do. Then he says, be hospitable to one another without grumbling. As each one has received a gift, minister it to one another. As good stewards of the manifold grace of God. Anyone, and he goes on down, if anyone ministers, let him do it as with the ability that God supplies. This is almost exactly what we've been talking about. God has given us individual gifts, individual talents. He says, what's the purpose of those talents? That I can stand before other people and have people say, wow, he's a great speaker, or wow, they are such a good, whatever your talent is. So we know that's not it, that they're supposed to be, we're supposed to use it as for glory for ourselves. Because I'm supposed to use it to minister it to those around. I use my gifts and my talents to help Sean, to encourage Sean, to help some guy off the street that comes in and asks for help, or whatever. It doesn't always mean that I have to give him $5, but I use my talents for his glory by ministering to others. He says, above all things, love one another. Jesus said the same thing. Is it really that important? Do we really get that? But that's what he's talking about. Yeah.
I think one of the verses that should be preached more and is overlooked the most is 9. The thing that holds us back is the one thing he says we shouldn't be doing.
Grumbling.
Absolutely. I mean, when you see a congregation and you go there and you see that they're not growing, it won't take you long to find out what the problem is. people are not doing what Paul said. They're not loving one another and holding them up. They're all looking around and grumbling about the situation. They're not trying to fix it. They're not trying to be a part of the solution. They just want to complain. And that, in and of itself, changes the focus of where it should be on others and yourself.
Well, it's a lot like 1 Corinthians 13. It says, whatever you do, your motivation should be love. If I go help Jared move, but I don't do it out of love, then he said it's pointless. If I go there and I'm like, man, I gotta go help Jared move. You know? We grumble, we complain. In our own mind, our attitude is not one of love, it's out of obligation. I'm gonna serve someone else. I remember about 3 weeks ago when a guy showed up around here, his name was Lonnie. Three or four weeks ago. Because of this study, because we've been thinking about this so much, and also because of our mission trip to Dallas, and they're taking a little bit different approach in my thinking toward people like Lonnie, toward guys like Lonnie. Immediately when he shows up, what do you think? Oh, someone asking for help again. I mean, I've done it a thousand times. I always was the one that got fed, the homeless bum that came off the street. Barbara Taylor would always, David, you got a visitor? Like, they come sit in my office for 3 hours. And I didn't have, you know, I had no checkbook or any money to give them. They just wanted me to kind of be the person that told them we weren't giving them anything to go back outside. So I've done it hundreds of times. He came in, and I decided to take a little bit different approach. And I thought, I'm just going to be interested in it. I'm just going to try to love the guy for who he is. And we talked for like over an hour in my office. He's a really odd guy. Okay, very, very odd. I'm sure people say that about me behind my back. But he was just very odd. And he had a very colorful life story. And he was just telling me every detail about his life. I didn't even want to hear it all. But he'd been in prison, and he'd done this, and he'd done that. He'd been an alcoholic, and he'd been on drugs, and he did all these things. He's trying to get his life turned around, and he's just struggling because he just can't seem to get over the hump. And so then we started talking about religion. We started talking about God, about Scripture. And he was interested in it. He knew some Scripture. And the thing is, he never asked me for a dime. The whole time we were in there, he never asked me for anything. All he said, well, I came here, he wanted something to eat. And he wanted our prayers. Now, we did end up helping him a little bit. But the point is, he didn't ask for it. And he came and he went that night. And didn't hear from him and that's exactly what normally happens. I'll be at church on Wednesday night. See you there. And they never come. You know? I hadn't really thought too much about it other than every time I see, he sells those newspapers somewhere. And every time I see one of those, I think of Lonnie. About 3 days ago, just out of the blue, Lonnie calls me. Hey Dave, how's it going? Pretty good. How about you? I'm still struggling, but everything's good. Everything's good. And I thought, oh great, here we go. He's gonna ask me for money or something. Yeah. And I said, so what's going on? I just wanted to call, see how things were going. Up at the church, see how everything's going. I said, you know, you never did come. We were looking for you on Wednesday, and you didn't come back. So we're wondering what happened to you. We're interested in you. We want you to come to the Bible class. Oh, I know. But I've gotten this job, and I'm working, 10 hours a day, and I haven't been able to come. So I just, all right. Well, I just wanted to call. Bye. You know, very odd conversation. But what he realized is that by him coming here, what we showed him was love. I introduced him, and I know you guys thought I was totally weird. I went around and introduced him to everybody. Hey, Johnny, this is Lonnie. Hey, Lonnie, how's it going? You know, and so I was introducing him to everybody. And then I had to get on the bus, and I said, all right. I put somebody in charge. I said, make sure that Lonnie's taken care of. Make sure he gets upstairs. He knows where the food is. He gets enough food, whatever. And the guy was positively influenced. Whether it'll ever make a difference in his life, I don't know. But what I normally would have done is I'd have probably turned him on. Well, okay, what is it that you need? Well, okay, well, we don't have any money. You know, I mean, I'll never approach anybody like that, but that's, I know that sometimes our attitude. Just taking a different approach, thinking about other people in love, no matter who they are. Thinking of them as, and he says this in the book several times, thinking of them as if you were Christ. How would I treat Christ if he came into my life? And, you know, there's a passage that's kind of haunting, talking about how sometimes angels come to us unaware. We don't really know. It may be an angel. Who knows who it is? That I need to treat everybody I come in contact with love and respect. And I need to show them the love of Christ. And they can see right through it when I'm faking it. And so I've got to, in my own life, develop a genuine love for my brothers, but also for those around me. Yes?
I'm reading this book right now called Experiencing the Father's Embrace, or something like that. And it was talking about how a lot of people, a lot of Christians really struggle with doing service out of obligation to kind of make up for them being perfect. And how, and we studied in at Florida a lot about, I was a Bible major there, we studied a lot about Peter and why he waited so long to get into ministry and how the guilt he had to overcome freedom in the difference. Jesus and when he betrayed him,
mm-hmm.
and then afterwards when he started writing, and the freedom that he experienced by allowing that grace to forgive the mistakes that he had made, and just accepting that grace fully. And when you mentioned obligation, that's what I thought. Like, a lot of people really struggle with just starting to kind of earn back the grace that they were given, instead of coming out of understanding God's love and just kind of
Mm-hmm. Definitely, that makes a lot of sense. I think that is a huge struggle. I mean, that's why so many people are turned off by us and by our service sometimes, because it's obvious that it's done not necessarily out of love, but out of obligation. And that's, but we gotta realize the gift for us is free. Grace was free for us, and I respond to God through love, but not out of obligation. We got a long winded preacher today, so we're ready to switch.
Chris will be back next.